tonight on Arena. Ian Rankin on his latest John Rebus novel, and King Frankie, Time Stalker and Salem's Lot are the movies up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Tonight on the programme, we're going to start with our film reviews. We have Kingpins, Vampires and an Unrequited Love So Strong It Defies the Conventions of Space and Time. King Frankie stars Peter Coonan as Celtic Tiger-adjacent wheeler dealer whose comeuppance has far-reaching consequences for all around him. The fatal attraction of the very wrong kind of man is at the heart of Alice Lowe's surrealist comedy feature Time Stalker, about a woman doomed to make the same mistakes in love ad infinitum. And Stephen King's second and much-loved story, Salem's Lot, is adapted for the screen. Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington have been to the cinema for us, and they're both with me in studio this evening. And let us start with the one that's closest to home, that is King Frankie. Who? What is the basic setup here? We're across two time frames, which is a bit of a theme this evening, in fact, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. We are Peter Coonan is Frankie Burke, and when we meet him, he's this kind of sad-eyed Dublin taxi driver, and he keeps himself quiet. His father, who's played by Owen Rowe, has just died, and apparently, you know, he's a very sound person, and everybody's sad about that. And he's preparing for the wake and the funeral. But he's kind of troubled by, sometimes people's reaction to him seem to be negative. And then we then find out, we drift back to 2009, when he's in his full Celtic Tiger
mode.
Does this very flashy birthday party for his 8-year-old daughter at a big hotel. His 8-year-old daughter just wants to play with her friends and be left alone. But he's in the midst of all this. He's wheeling and dealing. The hotel manager is looking for him because he hasn't paid the bill. He's got some stooge at a casino to try and keep his account floated. He's one of these people who's trying to juggle everything at once. And something changes when his business partner turns up, having found out that, you know, it's all a Ponzi scheme, basically. And something happens that changes everybody's life. So he's dealing with the consequences still of something he feels a lot of guilt about.
A lot of this film lands on squarely on the shoulders of Peter Coonan, who really has to, you know, carry both time frames and is the centre of the story, Ruth.
Yeah, I mean, without Peter Coonan, I couldn't imagine this film. I just couldn't imagine it. He's really, really good in it. We still think of Love Hate when you think of Peter Coonan and The Missing Tooth, and he's kind of all teeth in this as well. He's kind of flashy teeth. They've got a way of catching the light off his glasses. He's wearing glasses.
He doesn't smile much in the present, but a lot in the past.
Yes, that's right. He's very toothy in the past, and the glasses catch the light he's older now since Love Hate, and so he's got quite a thin face, and he looks drawn, very, very kind of drawn and tense. And he's always in motion, particularly in the early part, because he's trying to hold, as you said, the Ponzi scheme together. So he's trying to hold all these moving parts together, and it's going to come crashing down around him. And he's also trying to give his daughter the birthday party of his dreams, not her dreams. He said all she wants to do is play with her friends, and he wants her to have, and there's an amazing over-the-top cake. And like all films, something nasty happens to the cake.
Yeah. But that all sounds very Celtic Tiger-y, that aspect.
Yeah, and this is a movie, this is a first-time film. It's very low budget. It's the filmmaker Dermot Malone comes from advertising, and so he's got an eye for that kind of flashy, over the top stuff, which he was probably promoting, in another life. But he can deconstruct it very well too.
And clearly, the father son relationship, which is all in the past period, because as you said, Paul, we're dealing with in the present, waking the father and the father's funeral. That relationship is very important, and you get a wonderful sense of the dynamic between Peter Coonan as Frankie and Owen Rowe, who plays the father in this scene. The father smells that there's something bad going on,
does,
for
he
sure.
Does, he does. Yeah.
Let's listen to a scene where he's confronting Peter Coonan about that little bit of language within this.
What's that about?
Nothing.
What's going on, Frank?
There's nothing going on, Dad.
Well, since when did you hang around with a bunch of chancers like that, huh? I don't even recognise you anymore.
Look, I'm not a child anymore.
No, but you're my son. And you were always decent. I'll tell you what's not decent. That's those fuckers out there.
Look, Dad.
No, you look. And take a good look. Because I don't know what's going on with your life and what kind of mess you're in, but this place, those fucking wankers, none of it's real.
That seems pretty real to me.
What's going on, Frank?
Look, how many times do I have to tell you? There's nothing going on.
Do you think I'm stupid?
Look, I have it under control, Dad. I've got a plan.
Now, look, son, look, I can help you.
Oh, would you fucking leave it?
What?
I haven't got time for this. Have a fucking drink or something, will you?
Frankie.
I've got business to attend to. Enjoy the day.
That's Peter Coonan and Owen Rowe in a scene from King Frankie, a debut feature from Dermot Malone, who wrote the script as well. But
yeah.
Ruth was saying it's on a shoestring budget. Boy, did he get the actors.
Yeah, he did. The Frankie says there, I've got a plan. It reminded me of Mike Tyson. Everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. But I think it really is. There are some nice performances around him, but it's really Peter Coonan. And he's one of those actors who, he's such a good screen actor now, and he really trusts that the camera is going to pick up whatever. This would have been so easy to get wrong, especially in the past, and he's so good at being quiet and doing little. And there are some beautiful scenes, actually. Some of the best scenes in the film are late on when his business, without giving anything away, his business partner's son, who has reason to be aggrieved, on the Bull Wall, they have this conversation, and actually the young fellow is very good too. It's a really, really good conversation, and you just see what a really good actor Peter Coonan has become.
And he has to manage that. Is it 10 years, a decade between the two time periods that are there? Does he pull that off well, Ruth?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it is, as I was saying, it's about the movement, because they don't bother too much with ageing.
Yeah.
And they don't need to, because the story tells itself. It's really, really clear when it's present and when it's past. We don't have to worry about that too much. But it's absolutely, it's the way he holds himself, his kind of cockiness in the flashback sequences, and then his absolute kind of defeat and his loss of confidence and self-respect that completely marks the way he is, just his kind of being in the film.
Were there other performances that stood out for you, or is it really all
It really is. I mean, it really is his show, and I think it was a bit of a shame that I know it's quite short, it's quite low budget. Some of the other characters remain very underdeveloped. I mean,
Olivia Caffrey would like to see more.
Yeah, would have really.
She's the wife, is she?
She's his wife, Jenny, and she's really good at the party because she knows it's going wrong, and she's really anxious, but she can't stop him, and she sees through the whole thing.
Yeah.
But then in the present, she's barely there. You know, she's just somebody sitting at a wake, and again, the daughter who's, you know, party kicks all this off. Is the daughter, you know, she doesn't get much of a part. So I think that there probably are characters who, in a bigger budget, slightly longer film, could have been given more screen time and the story would have benefited from it.
Yeah. I think that as a debut feature, it shows, as we're saying,
shows
a lot
of
promise.
Huge
and
promise.
The way it's shot is really nice, especially as it's on a budget. There's a lot of soul in the way it's shot. I think the slight misstep is in the film's climax, again, giving nothing away. We get sort of some Mozart's Requiem and slow-mo, which we didn't need because it's out of kilter with the rest of the film, which is actually very sombre in a very nice way. So
well, it may well have been
film.
It's down to what you're saying, budget too, and development time, the time that you need to develop a script again. But clearly it sounds as if Dermot Malone is one to be watched.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, really looking forward to the next one.
Stars from you on this one first, Ruth?
I gave it 3.5.
3.5. What did you say, Paul?
I'd do the same, 3.5. Yeah.
3.5. Yeah. King Frankie, debut feature from Dermot Malone with Peter Coonan. It sounds like in an award-winning role. The first of our three films this evening. Let's move on then to Time Stalker, an obsessive love that defies the natural laws of space and time. That's what we're talking about with comedian Alice Lowe's new film, Time Stalker. A 17th century woman initially falls in love with the preacher and then manages to stalk that same character as a different character, as a different type of person, in different historical contexts over the next an hour and a half. It sounds a bit far-fetched, but there's something kind of... It has a quaint charm, this setup.
It has, as anything with Alice Lowe involved and she wrote and directed it, it's full of charm and sort of this kind of sort of dark whimsy, if you could put it that way. And she is wonderful in it. And everybody she plays is called Agnes.
Yeah.
And the first Agnes, as you say, is a I think she's a seamstress.
Seamstress, yes.
And she goes off to see this firebrand preacher, and he's about to be broken on the wheel, which sounds terrible. And everybody's looking forward to this except her. All the crowd are eating popcorn and everything. And she meets an unfortunate end. And then it repeats itself through time. This, again, is a film on a shoestring budget, and it's very difficult to do time travel on a shoestring budget. Sometimes she gets away with it, sometimes she doesn't. I thought the 18th century part where she's wearing wigs three times the size of her head and all that all works very well, and she knows what to do with that comedy. I think later aspects are more difficult, maybe. But there's something underneath it as well. There is a kind of a feminist treatise underneath it that is, I mean, that's not very subtle, but it's there.
While the Alice character remains the same, Alice Lowe's character as
Agnes,
she stays as Agnes, but she's indifferent. Whatever, she's a seamstress. One thing I think she's possibly,
she gets flashbacks in which she
remembers all the time. Yeah,
and flash forwards.
Yeah, I get those sometimes.
Yeah.
In the midst
to the 1980s.
Yeah. She keeps getting flash forwards to the 1980s. Yeah. Big hair and the leotards, which we all know we're going to want to see that particular part of her life. But the men, let's talk first of all about the men around her. Again, similarly, they all have the same name no matter what era we're in, and they're more or less the same character, just
they are
in
indeed.
A different context.
The love interest is, he's just love interest. He's this very, very pretty guy. Aniran Barnard plays the part.
He's not very nice, though. None of them are.
No, none of them are nice, but he's eye candy.
He looks nice.
He looks very good, and he's kind of... He looks, he's got the sort of floppy hair and the dark curls, and he's absolutely vain because he knows how good looking he is, and he doesn't care about, like, she's literally tripping over to get him, and he's completely, he just dismisses her and he goes off.
In one era, she not to give it too much away, she gets beheaded by a carriage and he doesn't even notice her.
That's right.
I think that era lasts something like a minute of screen
time.
That's right. And then there's another where she dashes to get the cigarette that he's thrown away because she's such a huge fan. This is in the pop era. And then on the other hand, starting right from the early scenes, she's married to this absolute creep who's totally overweight. He's played by Nick Frost. He's totally overweight, he's abusive,
he makes animal noises,
he does, and he is a pig, really.
Yes.
And so she, she's sort of reconciled to being married to him, and then she looks at him again and thinks, oh God, this is just a crisis. And then she's going to die anyway, because she always dies at the end of, this is not to give an
yeah, answer, at, you know, at every at every era she has to be,
she has to, she has
reborn
to die
in the new era.
That's right. And she's, and each time she's reborn, she hasn't learned her lesson. Yeah. She still falls in love with the cad again.
And she still has, in most cases, it's in the early eras, historical periods, it's a maid.
Yes.
Later on, it becomes a friend.
Yeah. That's right.
All of them, this is Meg, all of them played, of course, by Tanya Reynolds, because they've all been reincarnated.
And she's, the Tanya Reynolds character is in love with Agnes, but Agnes couldn't care less, because she's not particularly likable either.
Although she possibly should listen a little bit more to her than to anybody else. Okay, here she is. I think this might be the 1980s era that she's talking about. This is the 17th century, in fact, where she's talking about... there's something missing, because she knows this man that she has met in a previous life and is going to meet forever in a day, that there's something not quite there in her life.
It is like a memory, a yearning to return somewhere I have not yet been. Do you see what I mean?
No.
Of course you do not. You have the mind of a lamb. Mine is not that much bigger, but yet still I trouble myself.
We are all prisoners of our destiny, mistress.
Can I have that tonic?
Yeah.
Yeah, and no matter what period we're in, that is Alice Lowe as Agnes and Tanya Reynolds as Meg in a scene from Time Stalker. No matter what era we're in, there's a kind of a modern sensibility in some of the language and in some of the delivery, which makes it quite accessible in that regard. I'm conscious that what we've described sounds like a very confusing switch across time. It's really easy to follow.
Oh, no, absolutely easy to follow, because they're really gags. It's not a story.
Yeah.
It's a set of gags. So each time she moves into a different time period, it's a set of gags, but we also always know what's going to happen to her, because that's the setup. And the idea is, I'm not entirely convinced by its feminist credentials, but the idea is that women they always fall for the wrong man, and really the loving woman beside you is the woman you should be,
and that nobody ever changes.
Men don't change.
Women do change their costumes, then they get
and their wigs. There's a canary.
We're brought back to leotards and aerobics in the 1980s.
Yeah, a period was a real I want to revisit.
I don't think
detail.
Many people do.
No, and there's also, we have to remember the poor canary, because there's a canary that meets a nasty end in sequence after sequence. It's regularly decapitated and then it reappears.
It's talking about romance all the time. So when we get into the 80s, we're with the new romantics. Kind of just works. Does it sustain, as Ruth was saying, Paul, it is essentially a kind of series of vignettes. Does it sustain for a full hour half? Do I need to go to Ruth on it and let you get a drink of water there?
It doesn't really.
Paul and I have spoken about this already, so I'm going to ventriloquise for Paul while he recovers in the corner here. So we both agree that it is a bit repetitive, because the point is it's repetitive, but it is repetitive and it's quite thin. So again, as Paul was saying, it is very low budget. It's a series of gags. And we were both saying that, it recalls sort of Peter Greenaway, The Cook, The Thief, Draftsman's Contract, also very Monty Python. You got it in that sequence. And so it's very English as well in its terms of reference.
But an hour of
an hour and a half is enough.
A lot of the stuff I said. Thank you, Ruth. Coughing fit there. No, it doesn't. It doesn't really sustain itself. But it's very amusing when it is amusing, and she's just great.
Yeah, I mean, even the opening sequence says, "What time is in Bumfup?" 1688, and you just think, "Okay, right. I know what we're in. We're in a farce, and that's where we stay." Stars from you in this one, Paul.
Three for me.
Three, and Ruth?
Yeah, three as well.
A solid three from you as well for Time Stalker. Move on then to our final film this evening, Salem's Lot. Where would modern cinema be without the extensive back catalogue of novelist Stephen King? We'll be talking about The Shawshank Redemption later on. But for our final film this week, we are going to Salem's Lot, an adaptation of King's second novel, reputedly a favourite of his. It has been made for TV before. Is this, am I right in thinking, Paul, this is the first feature film adaptation of the story?
There have been two miniseries, one in the 70s, 80s, and one very recently. This is his favourite book, he has said. This is the first time it's been made for film, and I think we can see why nobody else has done it, because there is a quite a vast and complex plot in the book. And while, for instance, in The Shining, there was quite a complex plot, and Kubrick kind of threw half it out to King's disgust, in this, they're trying to keep it all in, and it's very difficult.
Yeah. If you start explaining what's going on in Jerusalem's Lot, we could be here for a while. Jerusalem's Lot being the...
It's the town that it's Salem, that it's set in. I wouldn't bother too much, because, I mean, it's a vampire movie.
Yeah.
So, people come to Nasty Ends because there's a vampire in town. It's very kind of Nosferatu, the setup. So there's the servant and the master, the coffin being brought to the old haunted house. A child is sacrificed. The village realizes there's something nasty happening, and very soon there are vampires going crazy all over the place. And of course, we know what to do with vampires, and the film doesn't really do anything new with what we do with vampires.
Yeah, don't invite them in, and watch out if they come to your door.
All the kind of usual stuff. Yeah.
Let us listen to a clip: a child vampire with surprise, surprise, glowing eyes. Believe it or not, just in case you don't know, he is one. Asks Mark, played by Jordan Preston Carter, to guess what? Let him in at the window.
The window, Mark! He's a maggot!
Open the window, Mark.
Open!
nice to meet you, Mark.
There you go. Burning by crucifix. Yeah. Beside a crucifix.
Insight.
What happened there. That, it's a good way to get rid of a vampire if one comes into your house, I'm told, if you're stupid enough to invite them in. I suppose the big question here is, we've had the miniseries, the two, as you pointed out, Paul. Mm. If you're going to adapt this for the for a feature film length, you're going to have to do something special, and it sounds as if Gary Doberman has not managed to do that as the director.
Not really. I mean, Stephen King was asked about it, and he earlier in the year, and he said that the film wasn't embarrassing or anything, which is a bit of faint praise. I think with Stephen King, you have a choice. I mean, if the book suits it. To some extent, with Shawshank, that was true. You can kind of stick to it quite faithfully, but if it's one of these big complicated ones, you have to make a choice and do something different, which really only Kubrick and a couple other people have done. And this is very much generic Stephen King film. You know, it just looks like a Stephen King film, and that's not really
And Shawshank was a story, so it was a lot easier to
absolutely much easier. Yeah,
but that's for later on. We're in the 70s. Is there anything to kind of attract us into this? I'm looking at both of you with your rather grimaced faces regarding this one. Is there anything to attract us into it, performances?
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of competent, but I think the direction is at fault here because you've got decent enough actors. I mean, Straker is played by Pilo Asbeck, who won't ring bells, but he was great. He was great in Borgen. And he was the creepy journalist in Borgen, and he's actually been in pretty much every Danish film that you've ever seen.
I like A Whiskey Priest too.
The Whiskey Priest was good.
Benjamin
Hickey, and they were good. And you know, Bill Camp, who plays the sort of good guy headmaster, is very familiar character actor, but they're wasted because they seem to be at sea. I mean, I really thought that Pilo Asbeck, all he does is kind of grimace and sort of wink at the camera like the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
He's certainly wasted, yeah.
Yeah, totally wasted. I mean, he seems to be more like somebody in a school play than in a feature film. So it's not his big break into Hollywood for sure. And I mean, the movie's been sitting on the shelf for 2 years, so.
Yeah. It didn't get a cinema release in America.
No, it didn't. And it's a real made for the back catalogue of a streamer. It'll fill up the back catalogue. People will turn it on late at night and watch it. But
I mean, and the horror aspect of it, would that be what people will attach to if they're going to attach to anything here?
Well,
Paul?
I think they might be disappointed by that because this is kind of jump scares and jump deaths, and there you can see them coming. I thought some of it looked nice, and I quite liked the glowing eyes that you made fun of earlier, Sean. I thought they looked kind of nice, I like the sort of Nosferatu-ish sort of aspect to it, but it just doesn't really hang together. It just doesn't surprise you.
Right.
I mean, it's being released for Halloween. There you go.
To be purely cynical about it, yes. Yeah. Stars from you on this one, Paul?
Two.
Two. Ruth?
Yeah, I'm two as well.
So
total concord.
We agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Wait for it to be on the telly next Halloween. Okay, that is Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington, the three films that we've been speaking about, King Frankie and Salem's Lot, on general release from tomorrow. Time Stalker is also available from tomorrow. It will be in selected cinemas.
Ian Rankin is without doubt one of the great writers of contemporary crime fiction. He is the creator of the iconic Edinburgh detective John Rebus, and Midnight and Blue is the 25th novel to feature the now retired Edinburgh cop. In it, Rebus must face his toughest challenge yet, how to survive behind bars. Delighted that Ian Rankin joins us on Arena this evening. You know, you've had this fella at you for a long time, it has to be said, Ian. He started in Knots and Crosses back in 1987 and nearly didn't make it to the end of that, I believe. Here he is, you shove him behind bars at the end of the last novel. He won't leave you alone.
He really won't, and also fans won't leave me alone. The previous book ended with Rebus in the dock and sentence about to be pronounced, and I thought, oh, what a great Reichenbach Falls style ending that is. He's on the edge of a precipice. What a great ending to the series that would be. Fans disagreed, Sean. They said, no, we need to know what happens next. What happens next? So I thought, well, what does happen next? He's found guilty. He's sent to jail in Edinburgh. And then there's a a murder in a jail behind a locked cell door, and no one can explain it. So who do they call? John Rebus.
Yeah, well, he's very close by, to be fair, because he's in the prison where the murder happens. Was it really just the fans in that nudged you, shall I say, into this? Or, you know, did you kind of find yourself itching to write a little bit more about him anyway?
Well, they definitely gave me a little nudge. They definitely did. And I thought, well, do I want to do another one? And as soon as I thought he's found guilty, he's in jail, I started to think about all the ramifications of that and all the fun I could have. I mean, a cop, an ex-cop in jail is a wanted man. I mean, some of the people in that prison will be people that Rebus put there. The others who don't know him know that he's ex-CID. So there's a certain amount of animus there. So he's always got to be on his guard. He's always got to be watching behind his back. And that gives you tension and drama from the get-go. And then if you add a murder into the mix where the prisoners all think one of the staff did it and the staff all think one of the prisoners must have done it, so the whole place is a powder keg, and the only person that might get him out of this mess is John Rebus himself. I just thought, what a beautiful setup for a book. I've got to write the book.
And down you sat and wrote, same. it has a touch, even as you describe it there. We would always think of you in the hard-boiled area of crime fiction, I think. You know, Dashiell Hammett, people like that would spring to mind. But here we are in a prison, which is a kind of a locked room, which is a bit closer to, I suppose, Arthur Conan Doyle, or indeed Agatha Christie.
Yep, or if you go way back when, you get back to Edgar Allan Poe, who wrote some of the very first crime short stories. Yeah, I mean, there's a long tradition of locked room mysteries and puzzles where you've got to work out how it could possibly have happened. But I just thought, I can't remember anybody writing a locked cell mystery. So that gave me the impetus to do something that hadn't been done before, with a form that is a traditional part of the crime canon. So that was fun. But, in, you know, Rebus in jail, he's got medical issues, he's got enemies in there. But also he has to try and get help from the outside world. Well, I mean, how, if you're stuck in jail, do you get help from the outside world? So I had to work all that out as well. And I was very fortunate that I knew a few ex-prison guards, and they managed to put me in touch with the governor at the prison in Edinburgh, and he invited me in for a little look around and a sit down, and he became a terrific source of information to me. So the details in the book, although some things are different, I had to make them different just to make it work as drama. But a lot of the details in the book about the way the prison regime operates on a day-to-day basis, hopefully, are accurate.
And you say you had to get some help with that, and Rebus needs a little bit of help as well. And his protege, I suppose we could refer to Siobhan Clark as, she is going to appear, and she's going to be involved with a friend of hers, Christine Essay, who's investigating this murder within the prison as well. Important to get those characters back in there, as indeed Malcolm Fox, his old nemesis, is around the place as well.
I think the thing was, Sean, I thought, God, I really want to spend the whole book in jail. What a claustrophobic environment. There's a lot of stuff you can't do if you're stuck in those four walls. And then I thought, well, hang on, if there's a murder in a prison, who investigates? And I asked, and they said, well, a normal CID unit would come in to investigate. So I thought, okay, so great. So I've got Rebus's old allies and people like Siobhan Clark and Christine Essen coming in and helping. But also Malcolm Fox sees a way that he can get into the jail to find out what the heck Rebus is up to these days, because he's a cop who investigates cops, or used to investigate cops, and he would love to have put Rebus away himself, but it never quite happened. So you've got all of that going on, and it also gives Rebus a kind of umbilical cord, because he manages to get hold of a telephone that he can use after hours to phone people like Siobhan and Christine Essen to find out what the heck's going on and to see if he can offer his help. And there's another case on the outside which involves Siobhan Clark and Christine Essen. A teenage girl has gone missing. At first it's a missing person case, but then a body turns up and suddenly it becomes a murder inquiry. And all of this Rebus is interested in, and there's only limited stuff he can do from his prison cell while trying to protect himself from being murdered himself.
Yeah. So inevitably what we get here is, you know, the stories will eventually intertwine. We don't need to go into the ins and outs of that. But I think it's fair enough to say that I suppose police corruption, when the rules must be broken, You know, whether the ends justify the means, does it matter how you solve the case, as long as you solve it? These are all questions that are going around in Rebus's mind. It's both of them going around in his mind, to be truthful, for a long time. But was that kind of moral quandary, does that inform a lot of the thought behind the novel, if you the ideas behind the novel?
I think it's certainly been true for me in the past few books that police corruption has been at the forefront of my mind, as it has for many writers who write police procedurals or novels with cops as their main characters, because the reading public, public at large, don't necessarily see the police as the goodies anymore. We look across to America, we look at police shootings there, we look at Black Lives Matter, then we look down to London, to the Metropolitan Police, and how the cops there tended to protect one of their own, even though he'd done terrible things, and that seems to happen time and again. And I sort of projected that to Scotland, to Edinburgh, and said, what if that level of corruption was happening here? So the last few books have certainly dealt with that. And Rebus, in the past, would have been guilty of his fair share of bending the rules back in the days when you could do it a bit more blithely because not everybody had a phone camera and interview rooms didn't necessarily have video and sound. So there was a time in the police when suspects had a way of tripping downstairs, shall we say, that police can't get away with so readily anymore.
But I think even some of the cases that you've alluded to kind of sideways in that last answer, it's very easy to work out the right and the wrong in many of those cases. It interests me how, in the case of Rebus, you get us in to maybe slightly murkier areas and have done this over the series with him, where we might find ourselves agreeing with the rule-breaking, even though we know it is rule-breaking.
I think the thing with Rebus is, you know, and I know that he is on the side of the angels. If he's pushing the rules, if he's bending the rules, if he's jumping over that line between right and wrong, he's doing it with the right reasoning in his heart. He wants to get a result. He knows who the culprit is, and he'll do whatever it takes to get that culprit, even if it means slightly moving away from the letter of the law. And, you know, is that the kind of cop you want on your side? I suspect if you're a victim, that is the kind of cop you want on your side. But wider society demands that our police officers and other professionals in that arena play by the rules. If they stop playing by the rules, then we lose something. We lose something fundamental to an ordered society. So, yeah, I think there's always that slight quandary in my mind and probably in readers' minds as well as to just how much of the hero of the story John Rebus is.
Edinburgh, of course, is, one could argue, another hero within the story, or is a heroine that we have would refer to Edinburgh as, I'm not sure. How important has that setting been for you in the realisation of Rebus across the 25 novels?
Well, I started writing stories and novels about Edinburgh to try and make sense of Edinburgh. I didn't grow up here. I grew up in a small mining village 30 miles to the north. I didn't really get to know Edinburgh or start to get to know it until I arrived here as a student. And I found it bewildering, a huge bewildering city, and a Jekyll and Hyde city, a city where on the surface everything was cultured and civilised, but just below the surface, terrible things could be happening and might well be happening. And every city, we know this, I mean, it's as true of Dublin or Belfast as it is anywhere else. Every city has its darker side. If you're a tourist and you're walking around the centre of town, everything seems absolutely fine. But you turn the wrong corner or you go to the wrong part of town at night and suddenly you get a very different vibe. Edinburgh's got it structurally. We've got the new town and the old town. We've got a rational piece of town planning, which is the new town. And then we've got the old higgledy-piggledy chaotic streets of the old town, the original city. So the Jekyll and Hyde is physically there in Edinburgh, the rational and the irrational. I just thought, what a fascinating city in which to set crime fiction. And nobody was doing it. I couldn't find anybody when I was starting to write these books who was writing contemporary crime fiction in and around Edinburgh. There was at least one person doing it in Glasgow and people doing it in other cities. But I just thought, I've got the stage to myself. Why don't I? Why don't I explore this confusing, complex, beautiful, dangerous place.
Are you any the wiser about it now?
Not much. Not much. I've spent 40 years exploring Edinburgh, exploring good and evil, exploring big moral questions of why we human beings keep doing terrible things to each other. I can't say I've come to real concrete conclusions about any of it. The process is ongoing, which is why I keep writing my books. You know, Beckett, Samuel Beckett said, you know, fail, try again, fail better. And that's what novelists do. Each book is a failure to say the perfect thing that you want to say in the perfect possible way, or to explore what you want to explore and come up with absolute conclusions. And because we fail, we try again. And that's the purpose of art. It's the purpose of literature, is to keep trying and hopefully take the readers along with you.
And I suppose Edinburgh also has its own literary tradition. Has that fed in to what you do, do you think? If so, how do you think it has?
Oh, definitely. I mean, this kind of idea of a Jekyll and Hyde city, Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote Jekyll and Hyde, he was born and brought up in Edinburgh. He partly based the Dr. Jekyll on a real guy who was called William Brodie, who was a gentleman by day, a member of society, but was a thief and burglar by night, and was eventually hanged on a scaffold that he had built himself because he was a carpenter. And he is then gives birth to Jean Brodie, the Prima Miss Jean Brodie. Jean Brodie tells us in that book that she is descended from a gentleman called William Brodie. She doesn't say, oh, by the way, he was hanged for being a wretch and a scoundrel. So you've got a kind of direct descent between Jekyll and Hyde and Miss Jean Brodie. And Edinburgh seems to me to be still that city, the city of people who are always hiding their true selves. Or hiding their secrets behind thick stone Georgian walls and net curtains. You just wonder what's happening. As I walk around the streets, I'm always thinking anything could be happening in that house and I would be none the wiser.
Has his musical taste, has it become more important, I think, in the current novel, in Midnight in Blue?
In prison, he's not got as much access to music as he has at home. He's not got his LPs and his CDs sitting around him. He can't sit at night with a glass of whiskey and listen to Rory Gallagher or Van Morrison, which is what he would much rather be doing than sitting in a prison cell. But you get echoes of music. I mean, the very title, Midnight in Blue, sort of echoes, you know, Miles Davis, echoes John Coltrane. It's got that kind of smoky midnight in a jazz club blues vibe to it. Music, I mean, it's always been important to me. I would much rather be a rock star than a writer, like many of my ilk. But some of us tried and we fell far short, I'm afraid. And so writing about music or having Rebus-like music gets me as close to being a music star as I'm ever going to get.
Ian, lovely to speak with you this evening. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Sean.
Ian Rankin speaking to us there about his latest novel, Midnight in Blue, which is published by Orion. The Shawshank Redemption was released 30 years ago in September 1994. Now considered a classic, the prison drama adapted from Stephen King's short story didn't exactly connect with cinema-going audiences at the time, mustering just $28 million at the box office from a budget of $25 million. A ray of hope, however, came the following March when it earned 7 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Actor for Morgan Freeman. On the night, however, Forrest Gump was the big winner and Team Shawshank went home empty-handed. However, the film's fortunes finally turned when it was released on home video a few weeks later. And since then, its stature has grown to the point that it is now one of the most beloved films ever made. Stephen Benedict is with me in studio to talk about Shawshank Redemption. First of all, let us remind ourselves of one of the film's most memorable scenes.
To this day what those two Italian ladies were singing about. Truth is, I don't want to know. Some things are best left unsaid. I like to think they were singing about something so beautiful it can't be expressed in words and makes your heart ache because of it. I tell you, those voices soared higher and farther than anybody in a great place dares to dream. It was like some beautiful bird flapped into our drab little cage and made those walls dissolve away. And for the briefest of moments, every last man at Shawshank felt free.
There we go. The Giottina Solaria from Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, as heard by the inmates of Shawshank in the film The Shawshank Redemption, 30 years old this year. And with us this evening to discuss the film is Stephen Benedict. The two soprano voices that we hear there, I think Mozart would have approved of the voiceover of Morgan Freeman underneath it, this lovely bass baritone that adds so much to the just the sound of that, never mind what's been said.
Yeah, and the wonderful thing about it is I think it expresses how liberating art can be.
Yeah.
You know, it really transcends the situation you're in, can transport you somewhere else. And that's really what the theme, that's the point of that scene.
Yeah, it's a hugely important scene in the film. It's such a popular film. Many people will know the story. Mm. But I was thinking about it today and I was mixing it up with something else. So just for those who might be in my boat or who may not know the film, give us the basic setup here.
Okay, Tim Robbins plays Andy Dufresne, a man who's wrongly convicted of the murder of his wife and her lover. He's given a double life sentence and packed off to Shawshank Prison, where he meets an inmate called Red, played by Morgan Freeman. And the story covers then the next 20 years of their friendship and hardship. That's really, without giving the game away, that's just the setup.
And I remember talking to Morgan Freeman. He was in Ireland a couple of years back doing a thing with the RTE Concert Orchestra. And we talked about the character of Red, who in the Stephen King story is a red-haired Irishman.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the fantastic things. I don't know, can't remember the lady's name. She was the executive producer on the film and was her suggestion to cast Morgan Freeman in the role, because until then, nobody had even thought of it, because in the script and in the book, as you said, it's an Irish character. And then that adds, excuse the terminology, colour. It adds shade, it adds depth and texture to the story. Because the remarkable thing is, outside of Morgan Freeman's character, there's not one reference to ethnicity in the film at all. He's there and they don't make a big deal of it. And that's one of the reasons why the movie still survives today. 30 years ago, it would have been an eye popper. But now we just take it for granted and we say, yes, this friendship between two men, irrespective of their ethnicity, their background, unites them.
And the Tim Robbins casting was probably a little bit unusual as well, because let's go to the point that this was a Stephen King story, and it was the Frank Darabont, the adapter, who said, I want to direct this.
Yeah, the interesting thing was that Frank Darabont approached Stephen King initially. And King was bemused. He says, why do you want to adapt this? This is just a short story and it's not going to work as a feature film. And it's, with respect to Stephen King's short story, Frank Darabont implemented many, 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 many changes. And every single change that he made improves the source material. Everything in that adaptation. I mean, even down to the aria there that we heard from The Marriage of Figaro.
We have a clip here of Darabont speaking about, you know, because you think, is that in the story where they all sitting on the ground listening to to Mozart when Stephen King was writing it? Here is Frank Darabont to say how that particular aspect came into the film.
The music itself is what suggested the scene to me. Had I not been listening to The Marriage of Figaro at that time, and I tend to listen to a lot of music when I'm in a writing phase, sometimes while I'm writing, music does suggest things. And had I not been listening to my Mozart at that period of time, I never would have come up with the scene. But then I started to fixate on the Solaria, on the Duettino. I don't know if any of you do this or if I'm just committable, but it's that thing where you're just like, oh my God, I have to hear that again. Oh my God, I have to hear that again. And suddenly you realize you've been listening to one song for 7 days. Just, it insisted on being in the movie. It presented the idea to me of that scene. And that's always superbly thrilling when that happens. Because it doesn't come from you, it comes from outside of you. It's somebody else's, it's music suggesting something that never, ever would have occurred to you otherwise. That's one of the reasons I always try to find I call it the musical identity of the script.
There you go. Frank Darabont, who directed and adapted The Shawshank Redemption, which was such a not big hit 30 years ago, but subsequently became one we're celebrating its lasting effects this evening here on the programme with Stephen Benedict. I interrupted you because we were saying that Frank Darabont got the rights from Stephen King and then submitted it.
That's right. And it wound up on the desk of the director, Rob Reiner. And the reason why it wound up on the desk of Rob Reiner was because he had actually made two very, very successful adaptations of Stephen King novels. Now, we've got to admit, a successful adaptation of Stephen King is very, very, very rare.
50, yeah, well, we, 50 of his novels. Our reviews earlier on tonight in terms of Salem's Lot, yeah, that's not a successful adaptation.
I think you can count the good adaptations on the fingers of one hand. So Rob Reiner had made Stand By Me, and he had made Misery, which won Kathy Bates an Oscar.
Mm.
And so Reiner said, OK, I'll make you an offer. He offered Frank Darabont $2.5 million, which is the biggest paycheck that Darabont was ever offered to his career to that date. And they said with Rob Reiner to direct, it was a very strong possibility the movie was going to get made with Harrison Ford in the role as Red and Tom Cruise as Andy Dufresne. And thankfully,
that's
Frank
Darabont's... That's a very different novel, isn't it? A very different film.
Completely different. And the thing is, in the casting of Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman, it means that the characters are the stars, not the actors. Because had it been Harrison Ford, it would have been Indiana Jones and the guy from Top Gun.
Yeah.
And it would have been a completely different thing. So the star baggage, what I think, would have swamped the material.
Yeah, and given that... So that casting was a stroke of genius. Mm. There was the addition of the aria, which is, I think, not only... The aria was always a brilliant aria, but it really became part of the popular consciousness after its use in this film. But what other types of changes did Darabont make to the story?
Well, the ending is slightly augmented. The studio wanted an extra scene at the very, very end. But as we said, the aria, it does not exist in the short story at all. Mm. In addition to that, what Stephen King had in the novella was there was a series of wardens that ran the prison. He amalgamated them down to one, which is very, very smart. The warden in the novella did not order for the murder of Tommy. He just has him reassigned to a different prison. And most importantly, I think the character of Brooks in the short story, he dies peacefully in a retirement home. But Frank Darabont did a brilliant thing. He followed Brooks outside of the prison. We saw him struggling to adapt to, and we know what happened to Brooks then. And so when Red is released, we are very, very fearful that he's going to follow the same route. And then he comes up with a great line, get busy living or get busy dying. Or sorry, the other way around.
I'm sure, Stephen, there are PhDs, theses written on what the Shawshank Redemption is, who is redeemed, what is redeemed, what does that title really mean? It's so open, isn't it?
Yeah, I think initially we think it's going to be the redemption of Andy Dufresne, Tim Robinson's character, but really...
He's innocent.
Yeah, there is no redemption needed for them. But so the story really is about Red, because he begins as a cynic. He doubts everything. And slowly through his encountering with Andy, he moves from a cynic to the point... He begins as a doubting Thomas, because that's really the underlay of the story. It's a very, very strong religious allegory. And so he ends up as a believer at the very, very end of the movie. And his final lines in the narration is that he talks about hope, hope and hope. So the movie really isn't... It's not a narration he gives, it's a confession.
Yeah, and also there's this aspect that Shawshank itself can be have a redemptive power, that prison can be rehabilitative as well as punitive.
Yeah, that's the very, very romantic, idealistic thing. And that's the thing I think that Stephen King drew him to the story. And I really think, Sean, that is what drew Frank Darabont on a very, very personal level to the story, because I think it's beyond just the religious allegory. I think it relates very directly to Frank Darabont's life. His parents were born in Hungary. They fled the country in 1956 because of the Soviet invasion. Frank Darabont was born 3 years later in a French refugee camp. And then his family was given the visa to go to the United States.
And also he came out of retirement to direct season 5 of the Netflix series Stranger Things. Hope, very important within that series as well. So it's still there for him.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's the reason why he was drawn to the story. That's the reason why I think he was able to augment what Stephen King did. And I think that's the reason why the film survives it's improving 30 years later.
And that's great. Thanks so much for coming in to speak to us about it this evening. Stephen Benedict there telling us about Shawshank Redemption, celebrating its 30th anniversary.
and the special place it holds today as a much loved classic. That is our lot for this Thursday evening here on Arena. Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Aisling Grufferty was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.